استمع إلى بودكاست رام قوتك من قلبك برعاية رام على تطبيق أبل بودكاست، سبوتيفاي أو أي منصة صوتية أخرى. في هذه الرحلة نكتشف مع بعض خلال شهر رمضان الكريم شلون نكون بقمة عطائنا المعنوي، الفكري والإنساني، ونستمد من هذا الشهر الكريم مصدر قوتنا الداخلية والخارجية.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2023, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's fascinating episode, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Like is often the case today, I don't have any ads to read. I didn't sell any ads on this episode, which means that I'm only getting paid for the dynamically inserted ads from the back catalog, which pay a lot less. And I really do rely on this support. Like, the reason this episode is happening is because of the support from patrons just like you. So if you're interested in pledging your support financially on an episodic basis, you can do as little as like a buck an episode. At a certain threshold, you get ad-free episodes of the show. And at higher tiers, you get more love and warmth and awesomeness. And I just want to thank those of you who already do it. If you're interested, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. My top patrons this week include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, David Compton, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so, so much. Okay, so let's talk about this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to have a chat with Dr. Erica Thompson. She's a senior policy fellow at the London School of Economics Data Science Institute and a fellow of the London Mathematical Laboratory. She earned her PhD from Imperial College, and she has worked on a bunch of different models and worked to understand the limitations of those models, everywhere from COVID-19 to humanitarian crises to climate change. And she is in West Wales, so we were podcasting from across the pond. She has a new book. It's called Escape from Model Land: How Mathematical Models Can Lead Us Astray and What We Can Do About It. It's a fascinating topic. We really get deep into it. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Erica Thompson. Well, Erica, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So you are in Wales. I'm on the East Coast now because I'm on my internship in Florida. So I think we are a 5-hour time difference. It's mid-morning for me, mid-afternoon for you.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. And today is actually a holiday. So I'm going to say this in advance to everybody. I hope you're having a good MLK day. Or actually, I guess that's now postponed. Podcasting is so odd because you're always time traveling. This will air next week. But yeah, it's an American holiday here, which is why I'm off of work and able to chat with you in the middle of the day. And I'm very excited to talk to you about your new book, Escape from Model Land: How Mathematical Models Can Lead Us Astray and What We Can Do About It. And before we even dive into some of the brass tacks, and before we dive into you and your career, I have to tell you one of the things, I mean, A, I think this is such an important topic, but B, I feel like when I first read it, I was like, okay, statistics, visualizing data, we can really screw with people by just changing small things in the data or changing the way we label things. That's what she's talking about. But then I realized you're actually talking about like scientific and mathematical modeling, like the art and science of modeling, not necessarily of just making graphs and charts. So there's so much to dig into. And I was hoping before we get into any of it, you could just tell us what you mean by mathematical models.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I guess I work on quite complex models. So things like models of the climate or the weather or the economic and financial system. And so these are sort of big fancy models that are in a computer. And, you know, you might be familiar with a spreadsheet perhaps, or a model which is more complicated than that. And they sort of take data about how things currently are, and they take our assumptions about maybe the laws of physics or the relationships of economics, and they use those to project forward what we expect will happen in the future. But in the book, I take mathematical models to be a bit more general than that. I'm interested in modeling as a sort of a way of creating a metaphor to understand more about a situation. And so those big computational models, they are models, but also a photograph is a model, or a map is a model, and they are useful in some ways and obviously limited in other ways. And so I'm interested in thinking about the uses, the ways that we can get genuinely useful information out of models, but also their limitations and where we come up against the limits of the metaphor.
So it really is this kind of broad definition that I love the way that you put that, and you put it in the book, that models are metaphors, models are visualizations, models are stories that we tell to try to describe really, really complicated data or complicated mathematical understandings of things, or even projections of things. Sometimes we're modeling things that we are known entities, right? And sometimes we're modeling things because we're trying to project or estimate how they will change over time.
That's right. That's right. And we use it to make decisions. You know, we're not just modeling the future for the sake of sort of making a scientific model that will be as accurate as possible. We're making a model generally with the intent of actually doing something, with the aim of, you know, changing how we act in the world to produce better outcomes. And so we use the model to investigate what would happen if I did this and what would happen if I instead did that. And then you say, well, actually, you know, I want to do this because it will lead to a better outcome. And so the model is really critical in helping us to think through what the consequences are of different kinds of actions.
Yet so often, I think in the, I mean, I hate the term the general public. I think it's so like degrading, but so often we, as yeah. the consumers, I guess you can say, of this information, don't exist in the gray, don't exist in this sort of stochastic thinking. And instead we jump to, oh, this is fact, or I shouldn't say fact, that's not fair. This is reality. This is how things will be. Like you were saying, this is how things could be if, and very often we look at a model and go, oh no, this is how things will be.
That's right. That's right. So we look at the model and we say, you know, maybe we don't understand all of the different sort of scenarios that have gone into making the model, or the different uncertainties in the input data, or even just the different ways that people could have made a model. You know, one person sits down and makes a model and they say, I think this is the really important part of that situation, but somebody else could sit down and make a model of the same thing, and they choose to simplify it in different ways. And so they get a picture which is coming at it from a slightly different angle and will give you slightly different results. You know, now you hope that in some sense, all of those are giving you a picture of the real thing, just from a different perspective. And so you hope to get moderately consistent information. But you can certainly end up with different answers.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's maybe a simpler way to kind of take a step back, and it's maybe a little bit of my how naive I was when I first got your book across my desk, because of the world that I operate in, which is psychology and historically neuroscience. I was not thinking of modeling large, complicated systems, but I was thinking of, okay, let's take data that already is. Let's look at, you know, data that we've collected that there are hard numbers. We know exactly what the outcomes were. This is all in the past. And it's like a lot of complicated data that a statistician, a mathematician, even maybe a social scientist can, you know, become very familiar with these data sets and start to get a feel for the data, start to really be able to say, I know what's going on in this complicated sample of data. Yet, in order to present our findings, you know, we write a paper, we publish it, we want to put it into a graph, we want to put it into a chart. Now we are making a model of complicated data. We're making a more simplified, almost metaphorical version of it that's visual and accessible so that people can look at it and say, okay, I can take away from all this complicated data a few points, a few relationships, and I can see the way that the data is acting in nature. But even that is not always, not ever really a fully accurate representation of the data.
It can't be a fully accurate representation, because to have a fully accurate representation, you need to tell me absolutely everything about all of the data. And yeah, you're quite right. You know, you're making a choice of which axes you're going to project your data on in order to fit it onto a two-dimensional graph to show it to somebody. So whether you choose, you know, axes that are meaningful in one way or axes that are meaningful to somebody else with a different set of assumptions, you know, that's your choice. And you then use that to tell a story. And so part of the art of working with data is choosing the axes that will tell you something interesting about the data, for sure.
And when we think about, you know, most scientists who are working very hard in their perspective or in their respective fields, and they're trying to communicate this data, and maybe even groups of scientists who are working in a more high-pressured situation, epidemiologists, for example, individuals who are trying to communicate important, meaningful data quickly to the public. You know, I think for the most part, we take for granted, and it's a good thing that we take for granted, that the goal here is public benefit, public health. It's how do I best communicate this information so that people can consume it easy and make good decisions. Yet we've also seen examples, and I just pulled one up while we were talking. I don't know if you've seen on Hulu, there's a fictionalized, kind of a dramatized version of the Purdue Pharma scandal here in the, well, actually globally, but also here in the US about the opioid crisis. And they show basically a chart that was produced by Purdue Pharma that for some reason the FDA and the DEA never caught and approved, where they completely manipulated data by compressing part of their y-axis so that it looked like it was garbage when you watch it. It looked like there weren't any spikes because they smoothed out the data line.
Yeah.
And you see this a lot, sadly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? That the communication of data always has a kind of political intent, right? So when you are communicating your data, whether it comes from a model or whether it's data directly taken from, you know, measurements, observations, then the choice of how to communicate that, whether it's done in a standard way or whether it's actually crossing the bounds of scientific reasonability, you know, there is always a political agenda behind that. And hopefully, you know, the political agenda is public health or public benefit. And of course, sometimes it's not. But, you know, you can reasonably disagree on even what you think are the good agendas. You know, you can, I think, if the agenda is public benefit, different people with different political standpoints will say that public benefits should be weighted in one direction or another towards, say, individual liberties versus the collective health outcomes. You know, there are reasonably different political weightings given to that by different people.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, because it's very easy for me. I think maybe I immediately went to the Purdue Pharma example because it's so egregious and because it's almost so easy to see, okay, this was clearly a profit motive. It was, you know, greed. It was a very obvious example where people were harmed simply to make more money. But more often what we're talking about is like these nuanced ethical questions and these, there is no true right answer, gray area examples. And that's really like, I look even just at the title of your book, or I should say the subtitle, you know, Escape from Model Land, How Mathematical Models Can Lead Us Astray and What We Can Do About It. Like very often, sometimes it's intentional, but very often it's probably unintentional, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that you don't even notice because you think, well, it's just obvious that this is sort of the thing that we ought to be doing. And I mean, that's something that maybe I'm particularly sensitive to because of my background working on climate change and climate modeling. So I started with a PhD in climate change, and my background before that was physics and maths. And so coming to climate science, you know, and obviously with all of the controversies around how we should respond to climate change, I think that's particularly interesting to see that, you know, that we have these models and we have the science, but then it is embedded in this social and political context, and the science can't completely be free of that.
Right. You know, I'm curious, you sort of gave a very good segue there into your background and how you came to what you're doing now. You know, obviously, as somebody who is originally, as you mentioned, studying physics and mathematics, I'm curious, was it really the social and the outcomes of climate change that got you interested in sort of narrowing your focus in that area? Like, was it because you wanted to make a difference in that place? Or was there something fascinating to you about the mathematics and the physics of climate change?
I guess it's kind of a bit of both. I mean, I've always liked maths and physics, and I really enjoyed doing fluid dynamics and sort of vector calculus. Yeah, we like it. and then kind of fell into doing climate because that was an obvious way of applying sort of fluid dynamics, you know, the atmospheric and ocean dynamics. And in fact, one of the first things that I was looking at was the flow of carbon dioxide in underground reservoirs. So thinking about CO2 sequestration, putting it down into old oil reservoirs to lock it away. And so I sort of got into it. And yes, definitely the idea of doing something that was genuinely useful rather than something that was just interesting was certainly up there in my mind when I started my PhD on North Atlantic storms. But, you know, I did a literature review. That was the first thing that I did when I came to my PhD. And the aim was to look at what different models would say about the prospects for North Atlantic storms in the future, given that the climate is changing and there's more CO2 in the atmosphere. And so I started looking at these different models, and I realized that actually they don't really agree. There are some saying that the storm tracks would go north, they'd go south, they'd get stronger, they'd get weaker, there'd be more intense storms, there'd be less intense storms. And you know, I think there's more consensus on that now, by the way, but sort of 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't really. There was this diversity of opinion among the models, and they didn't even agree within their own error bars. That was what really struck out to me, was that actually, you know, what is this telling me? If the error bars don't really even overlap, it's not telling me very much about the storms.
Right. It's telling you more about how they're modeling.
But
those
it's telling
storms.
Me a huge amount about the models. Exactly. Yeah. And the process of modeling and this kind of social and scientific process of modeling and thinking through what the possibilities are, and maybe telling me that we are overconfident in the way that we assign uncertainty. And so I started thinking about models, modeling, you know, what does the model mean? How should we interpret it? What kind of statistics can we do on this model output? What does it even mean to do that statistics? And where should we go from here? And so that's kind of been my journey for the last 10 years, is sort of looking at that in different contexts and thinking about how people use models and what they can get out of the models. Because obviously, you know, you can go all the way down and say, well, actually, as the famous quote has it, all models are wrong. Well, yes, they are all wrong because they are all in some degree simplifications. And so if you take more data, you will always find that your model is wrong. But that doesn't actually matter. You know, the models are genuinely useful and insightful, and they do contain information. But how do we get that out of them, given that the models are wrong? What does it mean to do the statistics on them? And so that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years, I guess, in all these different areas of application that I've been looking at, which includes sort of insurance and finance, weather modeling, climate, obviously, public health and epidemiology recently. Obviously, that's been a good case study. And humanitarian modeling. So thinking about how we predict a humanitarian crisis, if there's maybe an extreme weather event that's forecast, what do we do with the information that we get from the forecast?
I'm just so excited to dive into like a handful of those examples. But before I do, I feel like just to kind of stay on this point for a little bit longer, I can't help but think about kind of like the Kuhnian view of science as paradigm, and the fact that, you know, people, it's always people doing science, and it's sort of almost no more relevant, that understanding and that insight and holding that at the forefront of our minds, than when we talk about modeling. That, you know, the zeitgeist of the time, the stories that we're trying to tell, even the activism that we're sometimes trying to do, whether it is overt or whether the individual scientists doing the work, or scientists, mathematicians, you know, individuals doing the work, have these biases that they can't even verbalize or articulate, there is always a cultural, a human, a personal bias built into how we model, isn't there? Like, we cannot get away from the people, nor maybe should we. I think maybe making it more explicit is better than this weird old school logical positivist view that like science is clean and that, you know, it can never be biased. Don't you think it's more important to just make those biases explicit and say it's always going to be built in? Like, people are doing this work.
Yes, totally. I mean, I think that's the main message of my book almost, is to say actually that, you know, there is no objective answer. There is no way to sort of objectively choose in which dimensions we should be simplifying. And if we're using models as the input to decision making, then decisions cannot happen with information alone. You have to make value judgments, and the value judgments become implicit in the models, you know, from the point of somebody deciding what they're going to allocate funding for, to somebody deciding what they're going to work on, to somebody deciding, you know, how to make the model and what kind of methods they can use to do it, and the data that happened to be available because somebody funded them, or it was available because somebody was writing them down at the right time, or, you know, somebody had to make a conscious decision to collect the data in order to have it to use to make a model with. And, you know, everything, all of that. And then the political and social context that we've already discussed, it all ends up in there. And maybe at this point, I should say that there's also a spectrum, because some of the audience might be thinking, well, you know, what about the model of a ballistic motion or something. If I throw a ball up in the air and it comes down, it doesn't matter what my political agenda is, I'm still going to get the same answer and make the same model. And yes, you know, you're absolutely right. That is a key distinction, I think, between different types of models, and one that I try to make in the book, because I think that we have sort of essentially interpolatory models where we have lots of data and we expect that the next time you throw a ball up will be basically the same as when you threw it up yesterday and 3 years ago and 20 years in the future. Basically, the laws of physics remain the same. And so we expect that the data that we are collecting will remain relevant, and we can do the statistics, or we can infer laws of physics, and we can expect that those will stay the same. And we can take more data and make it more accurate. And that's great. You know, that is sort of brilliant. And that's responsible for much of the modern world. You know, the success of technology is underpinned by the success of mathematical models of the laws of physics and the laws of motion and all of these things. And they work, you know, they are brilliant. They are wildly successful. And so we can start at that end of the spectrum from a real confidence that mathematics is an appropriate language for representing physical systems. But then thinking sort of more along the spectrum from these, what I call interpolatory models, which are, you know, a bit like the weather forecast that you have in your pocket. You take it out of your pocket, you look at your phone and look at the weather forecast for tomorrow. And you can, it may not be perfect, you know, it doesn't have to be an absolutely perfect model, but you have an understanding in your head from your previous experience, and also perhaps from the statistics that the agency issuing the weather forecast might make available to you. You understand whether it's any good or whether it's not. You know that tomorrow's weather forecast is probably pretty good. Next week's weather forecast is pretty bad. And the weather forecast in a month's time contains so little information that they probably don't even make it available to you. And even if they do, you're not going to use it to make any life or death decisions, because you know that it's not very useful. So you have that understanding of the performance of the model and the limitations of the model. Now, when we're thinking about models which I call sort of extrapolatory, and perhaps climate change is one example, economic and financial modeling would be an example, anything with a social content would be an example of extrapolatory modeling, because the underlying conditions can change. You know, you can take as much data from the past about the financial markets as you like, but the fact remains that the social and political content of the financial markets is non-zero. And so there aren't laws of physics that will remain the same for all time. There are things that can happen, you know.
And like, we have no idea what Elon Musk is going to say
tomorrow. You don't know what Elon Musk is going to say tomorrow. You don't know whether some important figure is going to die. You don't know whether there's going to be another war. You know, who would... And in principle, they're not unpredictable. You could say, you know, there are many people who would have said that war in Ukraine would happen at the time it did. But incorporating that into a model, you would have to do it probabilistically. You couldn't say it will definitely happen this then. And nobody could really say that they can perfectly predict these sorts of things or even really put a bound on their uncertainty about these kind of events. And with climate change, you know, we say we expect that the laws of physics will remain the same. And so the simplistic models, which say, okay, putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere traps more heat for the following physical reasons, and therefore we expect that that will change the Earth's energy balance in a certain way, and we expect that that will then feed through into dynamical consequences for the atmosphere and for weather events and extreme weather and all the rest of it. And so we can have high confidence in the large effect and that there will be a change. But then when you say, well, we want to know what's going to happen right here in 2050, in 2070, in 2100, and you have to make a much more complex model to be able to do that. And you can make that model in multiple different ways. You have to make more judgments, and that's subjective expert judgments based on your understanding of the system, but ultimately somewhat subjective judgments about the degree to which the relationships which you've calibrated in the past will continue to hold in the future. So your model, which could be really well calibrated on the Earth of the 20th century, you know, that has an Arctic with sea ice. If you want to model the Earth of the 22nd century, you're going to end up with an Arctic without sea ice. Now, we expect that the laws of physics will continue to hold, but the way that we make these models, there are parameterizations of sort of grid scale processes, sort of on the 10 to 100 kilometer scale, that we just can't represent within the models because it would make them too big and too complex and they wouldn't run on the computer. So you have to sort of calibrate those based on the data that you have. But the whole system is changing. You know, the Arctic without sea ice is a different place than the Arctic with sea ice. So do you expect that the way that you calibrated your model will still be valid after we've gone through that change? You have to make an assumption. You have to make a judgment about a subjective judgment about model quality. And so this is what I mean then about escaping from model land, because my sort of conception of model land is when you are kind of inside the model. You say, I've made my assumptions, I've made my model, I've written it down, or I've put it in my computer, whatever. And inside that model, inside the bounds of the model, everything sort of works. And I can make my projection, or I can do my statistics, and I can tell you the answer of what will happen in model land. But actually, nobody cares about that except you. You made your model and you love it. That's okay. But the policymakers, you know, the decision makers, the people who have to actually act in the real world, they don't want to know about your model. They want to know about the real world. And so you have to escape from model land and make a statement which expresses your best estimate of what will happen in the real world rather than your best estimate of what will happen in your model land, which nobody cares about. And so to do that, if you're a weather forecaster, you've got loads of data and you think it's relevant data. And so, or if you're forecasting kind of what will happen when you throw a ball up in the air, you can do that with respect to the data. And you can say, okay, I'm 99% confident that this will happen, you know, and put uncertainty ranges and calibrate your confidence intervals and make, you know, a justifiable, accountable, defensible statement about what you think will happen in the real world. Now, when you're doing that with what I call an extrapolatory model, and you're trying to escape from model land there, you've got a whole lot more subjective judgments before you can take that step of escaping from model land.
And the thing about the model, so, you know, very often you are tasked when you're producing a model of having like some sort of public statement, whether you're, you know, going before a government body to to express the findings, whether you are writing some sort of like a big report that's going to be published. Basically, it's like one point in time. Whereas when I think about, I think the thing that comes up to me that's most relevant in my work, and of course, it's my podcast, so I'm going to make this about me, is that I, you know, I work as a psychotherapist right now. And one of the places where I really focus my energy and attention is in psycho-oncology and cancer and in end of life. And I've been learning quite a bit about how physicians, oncologists, palliative care physicians, individuals who deal in end of life prognosticate. And I think prognostication is so similar to weather modeling in that sadly, the closer you are to some sort of outcome, whether that outcome be death, whether that outcome be discharge from the hospital, whether that outcome be some form of recovery or no evidence of disease post-cancer, something like that. Once you get to that outcome, and the closer you get to that outcome, the more the error bar shrink, right? It's very easy to predict death within 24 hours. It's pretty easy to predict death within like 3 to 4 days. And then like, as you get farther and farther away from death, it's harder and harder to predict. And yet oftentimes when you're modeling, like with the weather, it's great. You can look at your weather app and go, what's it going to be like tomorrow? Pretty good chance it'll be like that. Something might happen. Who knows? But if you look at your weather app and go, what's it like outside right now? It should be pretty accurate. You know what I mean?
You'd
or like
hope
in
so.
5 minutes. You'd hope so. Whereas when you are tasked as a data scientist, that's not really your title.
I'm at a data science institute, so yes.
There you go. Okay, good, good. I was going to say, let's say like the royal you, the generic you, when an individual as a data scientist is tasked with putting together a model of, you know, the state of Arctic ice in 2070, and then they have to like publish that, you know, that finding, it's set in stone. It's not going to change. Yet we know it's going to change. There's no way this is going to be an accurate representation once we get closer to the outcome time, but we need to be able to make policy decisions today about what we think will happen then. That must be a scary prospect. You must feel the need to hedge every statement you make with so many caveats.
I mean, I think that's the potential downside of all of this. You know, obviously it's good to quantify uncertainties and to understand what the possible outcomes are, but of course you can go too far in the opposite direction and say, oh, actually we've got no idea. And that's just sort of no use to anybody.
Right.
And so I sort of, I guess I hope to encourage people doing this kind of work to be thoughtful about it and land somewhere in the happy middle between being overconfident in a model and sort of putting too much confidence and too much faith in it and just saying, okay, I've made all my assumptions. And then I assume that the model is perfect and I give you the answer. As if the model were reality. Obviously, that's a bad thing to do because we will almost always end up being overconfident and therefore over-optimizing our decision based on that information. But equally, if you go too far the other direction and you say, oh, you know, all models are wrong, there are known unknowns, and then there are the unknown unknowns, and you kind of go, oh, actually, I can't say anything at all about this situation. I think, you know, I'm really trying to encourage people not to go to that extreme either, because I think if you throw everything out, what are you left with? How are you going to make your decisions? But the information that is coming from the models is somewhere in this gray area in the middle. There is information. There is insight. There may not be quantitative answers. You know, there may not be quantitative projections of exactly what sea ice in 2070 or time of death or the weather in 6 weeks' time. Actually, the weather in 6 weeks' time, we probably do have quantitatively. It's just they're not very confident. But what do you do when you're in that gray area? It's quite uncomfortable, I think, for scientists and data scientists because, you know, you're used to saying, to pretending to be objective and to having the information come from the data, let the data speak for themselves. Well, they don't. They have to be guided. They have to be interpreted. They have to be translated. And I can see that in different contexts, people swing one way or swing the other way towards more, you know, more faith in the model versus a lot less faith in the model. And it's difficult to say what the right answer is. I mean, there isn't really an exact right answer of how much expert judgment and how much data you should be prepared to use. So it's an interesting one. I mean, this is the sort of the gray area where I operate, is kind of thinking, well, actually, in that case, there are all sorts of other things that are intervening on the decision, because there are the kind of political agendas, there are practical constraints, there are value judgments, there is sort of the difficulty of actually deciding what to do and convincing the people that are making the decision or the people that are in charge of releasing resources or that sort of thing to do it. And so the model may, in the end, in many of these, actually only be a relatively small part of how we make a decision about the future. You know, climate models are obviously a really important part of how we think about the future, but are they influencing what we choose to do about it? I'm not sure. It depends who you ask.
Yeah, I mean, I think almost like a perfect example, and one that you point to quite a bit, and one that you have actually spent a lot of your work on, is COVID-19. So clearly there was a public, not just a hunger, but a need to know, like, what is going on? How should I behave? What decision should I be making right now to protect myself? Am I safe? Will I be safe in the future? And you look at all of the variables involved. It's almost like, it's funny, like a model of a model, because there are so many variables involved. Like, even as you and I are talking about this, we have to model how we talk about it. What do we include in this conversation? What is too complicated? But, and every single parameter that we've mentioned so far, there's extrapolation, there's interpolation, there is public health, there is a political climate where there are a lot of pressures to go in one severe direction and the other. A lot of people, I mean, you look at an example, I don't know, here in the US, of course, because that's where I'm recording the show, of like Fauci early on being like, don't worry about wearing masks, and then later being like, of course you have to mask up. And certain people who are denialistic in their views in this country and hold certain political views being like, he lied to us. You know, there's all these things that came from how, like, did it escape from a lab? Did it happen in a wet market in Wuhan? Like, oh my goodness, how on earth do you even know where to begin? Like, I would love to just spend some time on COVID and what you've been doing.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm not quite sure where to start, but COVID, it's such a big thing, right? And everything else impinges on it as well. I mean, so maybe thinking about the early days of the pandemic, I guess, when we didn't really know what was happening, and the data that were coming in were sparse, and they were kind of swinging things in different directions, and it was hard to tell, you know, how fast it was happening and how bad it was going to be, and what should we do on the back of that. I mean, and then I guess you can say there are models of the information that we already have. So, like, thinking maybe of the models that we used, really quite simple models, just saying, well, how many people are infected on each flight out of Wuhan, say, and then using that to try to get some idea of how many people might be infected within the city and or how fast it's spreading and that sort of thing. And so those are kind of relatively interpolatory models, but with large, you know, large uncertainties on them. But then the models that were perhaps more controversial were the models saying, okay, if it gets into another country, how fast will it spread? And you can think of public health messaging in maybe March 2020, and the graphs that were drawn showing if nothing happens, it will go up and up and up exponentially, and this many people will die and this many people hospitalized and all of that sort of thing. And those sort of forecasts, of course, ended up being much more controversial, because you are then trying to motivate a decision that influences people's lives. And people, I mean, there isn't a right answer. People have different risk tolerances. People may be prepared to take one risk and not prepared to take another risk, and they can reasonably differ. There isn't a right answer to how much risk you should be prepared to take personally. But of course, with these collective action problems, the actions that one person take influences the risk that somebody else is taking on, and that's when it becomes hugely political and hugely difficult.
And so, how do you even? I mean, all of these things that you just mentioned, especially like even just spending a little bit of time on risk tolerance. When we talk about risk tolerance, this is something that is fundamentally part of the model. Like as you're starting to develop a model of potential outcomes, you're having to think about human behavior, which is probably the most erratic, the variable that is like the hardest to pin down of any variable that you put into the model. How do you even begin to, I mean, do you just say worst case scenario versus best case scenario and split the difference?
I think there's a lot of worst case and best case scenarios. And I think, you know, that actually there's a lot of criticism of the worst case scenarios, people saying, oh, the modelers were terribly alarmist and predicting things that never happened. And of course, that was never realistic and all that sort of thing. But I think, no, it is useful to have those worst case scenarios. And you never make a worst case scenario forecast with the expectation that it will come about. You make that prediction with the expectation of hopefully motivating some action to avoid it. And for the worst case scenario not to happen. Yeah, it's such a hindsight
bias, right? For somebody to look at a model and go, look what they said would happen. That was never going to happen. It's like, it didn't happen because they published the model.
Because it was in the model. And so there's this reflexivity, exactly. And it's the same with economic and financial modeling that, as you know, if your central bank puts out a forecast saying that there's going to be a recession, you know, it's sort of the other way around. You make a terrible forecast and then it does happen because everybody panics.
Right.
And the COVID is reflexive in the same way. You make a statement, you make a forecast, and it influences people's behavior, and then it changes what happens. What the outcome is.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But that's so much pressure. Like, I mean, and that's the thing we come back down to. We think, oh, the computers are doing all of this. No, the people are putting the things into the computers to make the computers do all of this. And they're ultimately making like massive decisions about boundaries and about error bars and about, you know, it's like we always say, like data in, data out, right? Garbage in, garbage out. Like you're like, people are choosing exactly what variables to put into the model, and then they're choosing how to contextualize this stuff. And then you're not even done once your model is done. Now you have to say, okay, how do we present this data to people? How do we make an image of the data? How do we tell a story about the data so that it's like easily digestible, so that people get it immediately and it influences their behavior ultimately? Like this is persuasion science as well. So, I mean, that's just so much pressure. Is it not? Like,
difficult.
Are you stressed all the time?
Well, I mean, I think the difficulty is here that, of course, the scientists are not the ones who ought to be making these political decisions,
right?
Because that, you know, that's the purpose of politics and of politicians, is that we delegate them to make or to sort of encapsulate our value judgments. And we don't expect scientists to be making those value judgments. We expect the scientists kind of, you know, in the very naive normative scenario, we expect the scientist to do the science and then the politician to come and say, okay, I provide the value judgments. You've told me if I do X, then this will happen. And if I do Y, then that will happen. And I prefer this to that. And so I'm going to do X instead of Y. And in theory, those two shouldn't be mixed up. Now, in practice, of course, for all the reasons that we've just discussed, the values and the politics do end up entering into the science as well. And so, yes, then there is pressure on the scientists. And when the politician comes along, maybe the politician actually would like it to be that way around as well, because they don't want to take the weight of making these value judgments. they can just say, follow the science. We will follow the science on this one.
Right. And they can do that whole thing where they go, I'm not a scientist.
Yeah. I'm doing what somebody else has told me to. I'm doing what, you know, my scientific advisor has told me to, and they're doing it because their model has told them to. Well, where's the accountability then? I think that's a really interesting question, is saying, actually, if the value judgments are kind of there all the way through, who is responsible? Who is ultimately responsible for the quality of scientific advice and for making these value judgments explicit, and understanding how we should be making this science advice and taking it through to decision making? Because you can't expect politicians to be wonderfully well versed in all of the science for all of the decisions that they might conceivably have to make. That would be unrealistic.
And you can't expect scientists.
And you can't expect scientists to be politically minded. And you can't expect them to have, you know, full training in all of the different possibilities. And you certainly shouldn't expect them to be making decisions on behalf of politicians.
And this is why I think about, like, you know, I think about Anthony Fauci, and like, what a thankless job he had throughout so much of his career. Like, he had so much pressure on him, and he took so many bullets because he really was wearing both of those hats, right? He was a scientist come science advisor who then had became the public face of everything. He was just the target and took the heat for any decision that was made within the administration regarding COVID. And it was... And under multiple administrations, which is an extra burden for sure.
Yeah,
polarized administrations. But I guess that kind of is maybe, I don't want to say a pushback to what you said, because I agree with everything you just said, but aren't there examples where as the public, we want a scientist in that position? We want somebody to wear both hats because we need somebody who can kind of cross those aisles.
And we need somebody who's trusted as well and trusted.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Crossing the aisles that they, you know, and I think you see that in most places that the scientific advisors took a very, a particularly public facing role during the pandemic and especially those early days in helping to communicate to the public, you know, because scientists carry that credibility, and they are in general trusted by the general public. I know you don't like that phrase.
Right.
People will look at them, you know, where you see a politician, and if you have, you know, you have your own political orientation, and that will cloud the way that you see a politician telling you what to do. Hopefully scientists are, or at least have been seen as, somewhat more neutral.
Yeah. I mean, it's So tell me a little bit more about the role that you have taken and some, I mean, obviously we've talked a bit about COVID and we've talked a bit about climate modeling, but where do you fit in that big equation, or where have you fit historically? And also sort of what are you working on now?
Oh, I don't know what I am. I suppose I'm the troublesome outsider raising difficult questions. Yeah, I mean, I have sort of a foot in these different communities, and I think it's particularly interesting to contrast the way that things are done in different communities. So, like public health versus climate versus economics and finance, and they have different ways of working and different ways of thinking, and so the models enter quite differently into decision making sort of flows of information. And so I suppose I'm the academic that studies how these work and tries to put them together. But I also try to be really rooted in actual practice. So I've had one case study over the last few years of humanitarian agencies making decisions in advance of humanitarian crises. So, for example, I looked at projections of heat wave in Pakistan and forecasts of cyclones in Madagascar. And so those are quite interesting because, you know, there is a demonstrable ability to predict. So you can say, right, there's a cyclone out there in the Southwest Indian Ocean and it's heading towards Madagascar. And in 5 days' time, it's going to hit Madagascar. And we are moderately confident about that, but not perfectly confident. It might swerve at the last minute. So what does the humanitarian agency do? Do they have the procedures to be able to respond to release funding quick enough to be able to do something to reduce the damage that might happen when this cyclone arrives? Do they have the the sort of robustness of procedures to be able to cope with the uncertainty of it maybe hitting or maybe not hitting. You know, what is the sort of reputational damage or the social problem with activating a response and then finding that actually nothing happens? Because that is a major problem of a different kind. And so how are the decisions made to sort of trade off all of these different possible outcomes and the ways that they affect either the community or the organization that proposes to make the intervention or the people that are in that decision chain, or the long-term prospects for continued funding of humanitarian action? You know, these are also important. And so there's just so much to think about. It's really interesting, I think. And the model is a critical part of that pathway. Because if you didn't have the model, you wouldn't even consider doing it. You would go back to your standard model of just waiting until something bad happens and then rushing in afterwards. But in principle, you could do better. In principle, you could reduce the damage by acting beforehand.
You know, I'm curious though, from a personal perspective, you know, when we're talking about these sort of decision-making positions that carry so much weight and all of this like prediction and, you know, you're sitting at a sort of precipice very often when you're doing this modeling work, and especially the position that you're in, which is a more kind of like global or bird's eye view, where you're not so much one of the data scientists who's just in it. But you're actually taking a step back and saying, okay, what is the outcome of this? What decision-making do we need to make based on this? I can only imagine the amount of weight that you probably feel on your shoulders, like especially when it comes to important inflection points when you're publishing and the real decision-making, like, okay, if then sort of processing and your risk tolerance. Like, how do you, A, is that the case for you? And B, like, how do you cope with that? Like, are you anxious?
I think not so much. I mean,
okay. So maybe you're constitutionally better at this job.
Possibly I just like uncertainty and kind of thrive under uncertainty. But I think, you know, maybe the more reflective answer is that I guess I see myself as sort of a handholder, that I'm not taking these decisions and I'm not telling anyone to take decisions. I'm trying to improve the process so that people can make decisions that they are happier with themselves and have a process for making those decisions that they will be happy with, you know, even in the event that the bad outcome happens, which it will do, because if you're acting in advance, you accept uncertainty. The only alternative to making a decision before the event is to make the decision after the event. So, you know, whether it's climate change adaptation or whether it's deciding what to do when you've got a hurricane bearing down on an island, you know, you can do better than by just waiting. And so I suppose I think that there's a massive opportunity to be grabbed by using the information that is available from the models more effectively. And it's just a question of not going too far. So if you took the model at face value and said, okay, we've got a model, it says that it's going to hit, that the cyclone is going to hit Madagascar in 5 days' time, quick, release loads of money. That's all very well, but the uncertainty and your risk tolerance for that uncertainty, you need to have thought about that in advance. And there isn't very much data. So you don't necessarily know exactly what the uncertainty is. And so I suppose I'm helping people to think through what the possible trade-offs are of different actions at different times, given the levels of uncertainty and the unknowns that end up in the models. And so you'd have to ask somebody else, but I hope that my contribution is positive here and that it helps to, that it helps people to understand what the range of outcomes are, what their options for intervening are, and what the limitations are to the knowledge that we have and the forecasts that we have. Yeah, and I think that's really important. You know, I think that's really critical because you could take the model at face value and over-optimize to what the model says, and you would get and you would do the wrong thing. You would be over-optimized, you would be maladapting, you would be doing something which turned out to be more of a risk than you were willing to take.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so much to unpack even in what you just said. The first thing that comes up, I mean, less so about the thing that you said on the tail end about, you know, really empowering people to see that range of decision-making and to check their own risk tolerance and factor that into their decision-making. But even before we get to that, you were really focusing on the fact that you're not carrying all of this weight. You're actually empowering the individuals who receive the data that you give them, who receive the story that you tell them. You're empowering them to make the best decisions for themselves. And I don't know, the metaphor that came to my mind was that sort of you didn't put the monster in the corner of the dark attic. You gave somebody a flashlight so that they could decide, you know, so that they could shine around and say, okay, now I know what I'm working with, or I need to make some decisions based on this. And I can imagine that must help you with your own ability to tolerate A, the uncertainty, but B, the weight of the outcomes of these things. Those things are going to happen regardless of if you modeled them or not.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, there are some things which we do influence the probability of them happening. So going back to your COVID example, having the model changes the outcome, but also for climate change in the 21st century, you know, what the climate looks like over the next 100 years, actually the question of what we forecast hopefully does influence what the outcome will be, because hopefully somebody looks at it and says, actually, we don't want to be going there and we do want to be going here. And so we should be making decisions that are sort of commensurate with that.
Right. And the good news is that the modeling almost exclusively, I can't say 100% exclusively, but almost exclusively mitigates, buffers, improves the outcomes. Because the idea is that, you know, if there is going to be a feedback loop, like you mentioned, if the model itself is going to influence the outcome, it's going to be in the direction of prevention or mitigation. It's hopefully the model is not going to make things worse.
Maybe. You know? Although, I mean, I think that possibly. I mean, with COVID, I think you can argue in either direction. I think that actually things have still nowhere near settled out. We are not post-pandemic yet. We are still mid-pandemic, and it will be interesting to see what the retrospective looks like in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, because there are so many knock-on impacts and ripples in different directions, whether that's health or social or political or economic, everything. You know,
it's true. I mean,
things have certainly not, we certainly haven't got a full picture of what the impacts are. And then I think climate, you know, the outcomes, are the models helping us make better decisions? In some respects, yes. And kind of in the naive case of just saying, well, you know, if we keep emitting large amounts of CO2 indefinitely, then that does lead to catastrophe. But the question of exactly how quickly one should reduce that and what the other political trade-offs are, I'm not sure to what extent the models are actually helping us there, because, for example, you could say that we had enough information 30 or 40 years ago to know that we should be reducing carbon emissions.
And yet were we, yeah.
And yet it carried on and carried on and carried on. And to some extent, people were using the models as a way to avoid making those hard decisions, because you can just say, ah, well, you know, we need more information. We need to reduce our uncertainty ranges. So I'll give £1 million to some government agency to go off and do some more detailed forecasting, and they come back in 5 years with a different answer. And until that point, we don't need to think about it. So I think there is, to some extent, a contribution of the physical climate models to delay on climate action, just because of this sort of constant scientific perspective that we need more information, we need more data, we need better models, we need bigger computers. And so you keep going away and getting more data and more information and bigger models and better computers. And in the meantime, things don't particularly happen. Maybe we're getting better, I think, you know, maybe just in the last 5 years or so at doing both at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can take an extreme example in which modeling literally doesn't exist. Like, we have no math, you know, and with zero models at all, you know, we are continuing, whether it be with COVID or with climate change, to do literally nothing and to have no consequence. Of course, it's going to be worst case scenario if we literally have no feedback mechanism at all. And so it's like, I guess my I guess my Pollyanna view here is that it's all helping. It's just, is it helping significantly, or is it helping enough, or is it, are we empowered to have these things help as much as we wish that they would, or are there forces that are pushing back against that?
So maybe then the next example I'd go to is the integrated assessment models of energy and climate. And these are sort of, you know, spreadsheet size models, big spreadsheet models of different sectors of the economy and different energy sources. So like how much energy will be from nuclear electricity, how much will be from renewables and all the rest of it. And so it's an economic model which you put all these assumptions into, and it tells you what the lowest cost way of meeting your targets is to 2100, say. So you say, okay, we want to meet the Paris Agreement target of 2 degrees of global mean temperature change, and that means X many tons of carbon emissions. And then you allocate those carbon emissions basically across time and across different technologies to construct an energy system pathway to 2100 that meets the target. And so that's a really interesting one, I think. It's a really nice example because those assumptions about price end up being first order. They are really important to the answer that you get at the end. You put in a price for fossil fuels, and you put in prices for renewables and nuclear, and you say, okay, in the future we expect that renewables will get cheaper because of technology development. And so you can see that a model like that will scale up renewables as fast as it can, and it will scale down fossil fuels, and it might use nuclear or it might not, depending on what sort of cost assumptions you make. And it will meet the target one way or another, because that's what you tell it to do. That's its constraint, its boundary condition on that model. So then you say, okay, so what else am I going to put into that model? And so recently models have included carbon capture and storage. So bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, which is where you burn wood instead of coal in a power station, and you capture the carbon dioxide coming out of the power station's chimney, and you stick that down into the ground so that it is captured and away from the atmosphere, and so it doesn't create carbon emissions. So you put that into the models. And it turns out that if you give that a low price, $2 per ton of CO2, for example, then your model will use lots and lots of that. And if you give it a really high price, $2,000 per ton of CO2, then it will use almost none of that. And if you give it a middling price, it will use more or less of it, depending exactly where you are. But the point is that that's an assumption that somebody's made. And it's something that doesn't actually, that price doesn't exist until we've measured it in 2100. And there's a high sensitivity of the model's recommendations to that assumption. And so then the choices about whether direct air capture technology should be developed, for example, taking CO2 directly out of the atmosphere. Well, that, at the moment, that's quite energetically expensive, and so it's quite financially expensive. But if you think that in future there will be technology which can lower the price of doing that, then you make a you make a more optimistic assumption, and you put that into your model. And then what you find is that these integrated assessment models rely very heavily on taking CO2 out of the air in the second half of this century, because it turns out to be cheap then. But we don't know that it's going to be cheap then.
Right, and
It's only going to be cheap if we start investing in it now. So are these models self-fulfilling? Because they encourage, you know, if you look at that model, which is published in the third, the working group of the IPCC's assessment report, if you look at those models, they say we need lots of CO2 sequestration. Do you say, okay, that's great, that means it's going to happen because it's economic and we don't need to do anything about it? Or do you say, that means we need to invest a huge amount in it now to make it happen in order to make these models come true? You know, those are two different ways of thinking about the same model result, but they provoke completely different ways of acting and policy interventions that you might make. And then, of course, there are other things which could be in the models, which are not in the models. So what price do you put, for example, on behavior change? How many dollars per ton of CO2 does it cost to to get people to turn down their heating or to choose not to take the plane or to choose to, you know, insulate their house. Well, nobody really has any idea because that's a social thing. It's not something you can really forecast. At the moment, that price might be really high, but in 20 years' time, if social attitudes are completely different, it could be really low. We just don't know. But that assumption, again, would be first order, because if you put that in your model as an extremely cheap way of achieving carbon targets, then it would be used. It would be extremely heavily used. And then the next one, of course, to be even more controversial, is geoengineering. So this is the idea of putting sulfate aerosols up into the upper atmosphere to basically shade the sun and reduce the amount of heat that's hitting the Earth's surface by reflecting it straight back into space. And that, in theory, would be a relatively cheap way of reducing the energy balance and cooling the Earth. And so if that were to be put into the integrated assessment models, and I have a sneaking feeling, or well, a sinking feeling, that that's going to be the next step for these models, is to put in geoengineering as the next backstop, you know, because it used to be renewables. And then when it was clear that renewables weren't going to be enough, it was the carbon capture and storage, and then it was the direct air capture. Well, next it's going to be geoengineering, isn't it? Because we're proceeding down this chain.
Well, and that sort of brings up my fear, which is a very sort of psychological concern. The way that people think in thresholds, in absolutes, in either ors. So like this very complex model that you're talking about, what happens if and when, and I'm sure this is already happening left and right, you plug all of these things in to be able to say what is the cost or what is the reduction necessary or what is the percentage, you know, nuclear, the percentage, and then you realize no matter what we do, or, you know, we're asking for something that is never going to be done. Like, we don't have the political will for it. Like, we know how our people act, and we're asking for a behavior change that's so drastic that it's just, like, our own government doesn't support that. And then people become very dejected by the model, and they go, okay, well, it's literally, based on this model, it's literally impossible for us not to burn to death. So now I'm just going to, like, party while the
yeah,
world burns.
Yeah.
And that's this really scary outcome, because people don't realize, no, something is better than nothing. Like, when we talk about these, quote, tipping points, they are arbitrary tipping points. We are choosing to say what happens at 2 degrees, what happens at 1.9 degrees, what happens at 1.5 degrees. These are human, like, these are constructs. They are not actual tipping points. And for some reason, that doesn't seem to be communicated.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, I really sympathize with that. I mean, I think the thing that people are missing is that 1.5 as a target is good to have as a target, but it doesn't represent anything significant about the Earth system. 1.5 is better than 1.6. 1.6 is better than 1.7. And if we miss the target of 2 degrees, 2.1 will still be better than 2.2, and 2.2 is better than 3, and 3 would be better than 6. You know, there's always something to play for.
Yeah, and also just plugging in numbers like you know, the year this, the year that, those are all just arbitrary targets that we're putting into the model.
Yeah, they are. They're arbitrary. And so maybe then from the kind of meta perspective, you're saying, well, what function are these models performing? Are they helping to motivate action, or are they actually counterproductive?
Right.
And if they are counterproductive, what kinds of alternative models could we be making that are more productive, that will help us to think more critically about the system and about the possible types of intervention that we could make? You know, I think one of the problems with the models that we have is that they are all sort of forecasting models. They start with an initial condition and project forwards. And so you end up with immense uncertainty about the future. And that is difficult. You know, that's psychologically difficult, especially when the uncertainty ranges include sort of catastrophe and utopia. It's kind of impossible to live with. So why don't we make models that go in the opposite direction? Why don't we say, here's my vision of what I want 2100 to look like. How do we
and
get
then here's
there?
What we need to do to
and
get
then,
there.
And then you sort of do your reverse modeling and say, well, what decisions would we be need to be taking now and in 5 years' time and in 10 years' time and in 30 years' time in order to continue on the pathway towards that future, which is the one that I want to be in.
And I think we're starting to see some of those changes, or at least I've noticed that when I'm reading some of these like large, you know, climate reports or these large public health reports, that I think that people are getting savvy to the idea that that's how you induce behavior change. But I also think, you know, having social psychologists as part of the team that really understand persuasion science, that understand, for example, marketing, like we have all this knowledge already. We just put it all in freaking capitalism and marketing. Yep. So like take it out of that realm and say, you know, what is that that sweet spot for people to feel, you know, both empowered, a little bit scared, but not overly scared. It's like, look at poker chaos theory. How do people make decisions at the poker table?
Yeah, yeah.
When do they go, this is too much, or, oh, I'm feeling like I really want to keep betting here. Like really understand the human side of it. And then
and I think that's
kind of tailor the models
important.
To that.
Yeah. I think that is really, because I think if we need to be thinking of models as a kind of aid to thinking rather than as a kind of prediction engine, then we should definitely start to do more of that. And I would really, really like to see more social, you know, social scientists and sort of the humanities and even sort of fiction writers, you know,
right,
because writing fiction is a way of making a model as well. Having more of these kind of imaginative and creative inputs to models rather than just the sort of the hard science, if you like. But also I think we need to be careful, because when you say persuasion and marketing, actually that's sort of a dangerous area to be in, because you're starting to say that we have the solution and
exactly
everybody else has to agree with us. And so I think that is it's a dangerous area to be in.
Yeah, it's almost like you have to go to the extremes, like how do we prevent mass casualty? Now let's do some persuasion science around that. But you're right, once you get into the nuance of like this is a better outcome versus that, well,
yeah,
according
well, exactly.
to
who decides?
Who's in
who
power?
Decides?
Yeah,
so that's,
yeah.
So that's that. I mean, that's again what I mean by the politics becoming embedded in the models. And when you start treating it as kind of a marketing exercise or persuasion, then we're in that difficult gray area. But maybe, you know, one of the things that I suppose I recommend for that in the book is thinking about ways of co-creating models and thinking about how we can have a more democratic input to models. What kinds of models are we making? Who has access to that? Who is able to make a model? Who has access to that sort of scientific information flow into the decision-making procedures? And how do we make that more accessible to a wider range of people with different perspectives who may be coming to it, you know, with more understanding of the lived experience of different kinds of communities? I think that is really important, you know, not just for the sake of getting a better answer, but also for the sake of getting social buy-in, rather than just ending up with the polarized situation that we do have with COVID and with climate and with many other areas, where, you know, one set of solutions becomes identified with a particular political perspective, and then the modeling itself ends up being distrusted or discredited by half the population. You know, that actually, how do you work with that? You can't, nobody can work with that.
Yeah, I think it's about finding that common ground. You know, so often, like I work in sort of a scientific skepticism arena as well on my other podcast on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And we often talk about how do we push for more evidence-based thinking in different arenas? And I think one of the things that we often talk about, you know, you're having Thanksgiving dinner with your like uncle who, you know, thinks climate change is a hoax, or you're trying to talk to somebody who has like a wildly different worldview, like they're, you know, anti something that you're pro, or vice versa, is like, what's the common ground? What can you actually agree on? And if we can find things that are like fundamentally human, like not wanting for the planet to become uninhabitable, you know, or like there are certain things where you can sort of broaden out and broaden out and broaden out. And then you finally are like, yep, we agree on that. Like ultimately to be human means to think this way. And maybe we just start there and then
work
backwards.
And I think if you ask more closely and kind of avoid the politics, there is more common ground than you think, that actually people do care about their children and their grandchildren and the sort of prosperity of society. but they have different visions of the way that it can be achieved and the kind of things that are important.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is how my father and I manage to still have conversations with one another, is that we both get that we come from wildly different political perspectives, but we always will say, after even a pretty heated argument, we both agree on the outcome that we're looking for, and we want the world to look a certain way. We just disagree on how to get there.
That's what it is. That's okay. I mean, I think this is going to be inevitable. The question is just making sure that it doesn't poison all of these personal relationships and the cohesion of society in the process. Yeah, we've got to find that common ground and work out from it, rather than trying to jump to solutions that are inherently political and then trying to persuade and market our way to telling other people what to believe. You've got to go with them on the journey and compromise, you know, and that means compromise on both sides, not just one side. And that is, tricky.
It is. But I think that's such a good kind of note to tie this up on, because I'm realizing I was like, we'll go 45 minutes and it's been like an hour and 15, but this is so fascinating. And I'm so sorry I've kept you for so long.
It's really interesting. And thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
It is. Of course. And I wanted to save time. Of course, I've already gone over the time, but you know, I close my episodes, every episode, by asking my guests the same two questions. And given your line of work and given the things that you really deeply ponder, I'd be so curious for your answers to these questions. So hopefully I can keep you like another minute or two just to close out the episode the same way I always do. They're sort of big picture questions, so apologies for that. If you need to take a little bit of time with them, that's fine. But basically, you're a big picture thinker, so I think it's okay. So I want you to think about the future, something you do all the time. And when you think about the future, I'm going to ask you two things. The first is, what is keeping you up the most at night? Where are you finding that you're almost maybe living in a bit of pessimism, maybe even borderline cynicism? Like, what are you truly fundamentally worried about? And then on the flip side, so we end on hopefully a lighter note, where are you actually finding an authentic hopefulness? Like, what are you truly, really looking forward to when you think about the future? And this can be in any context you like. It can be personal, it can be vocational, it can be global, it could be cosmic, you know, just wherever your head goes to.
Okay. So I guess what keeps me up at night, I guess I do feel really worried about the sort of social cohesion thing and the way that things are politicized and the way that that value judgments are so similar, as we were just discussing. You know, people do in fact have very similar values about the future, and yet somehow they've got projected onto political axes which paint these as being complete opposites, and then find it incredibly difficult to even talk to, quotes, the other side, you know, the other people with slightly different opinions about how things should be done. So I'm worried about, you know, how that gives our society, it makes us struggle to respond well to challenges. And, you know, you can see that in the challenge of COVID. And I think that was sort of a precursor to climate change, you know, which is on a much larger scale and longer time scale. You know, I'm worried about how we can effectively work together to meet the challenges, because there are huge, enormous, difficult challenges coming down the road at us apace in the 21st century. And in order to solve them, we need to work together. We can't do it if we don't work together. So I suppose that's what keeps me up at night. And then what gives me hope? I mean, lots of different things in slightly different ways. So maybe, you know, I think the future, as Kevin Anderson has said, there aren't any non-radical futures on the table anymore. We either have a radical future where we transform our energy system and social systems and everything to meet the, you know, the challenge of climate change and everything else that goes along with that. You know, it's not just about weather and climate, it's about all the other sort of energy and resources and everything. So either we meet that by changing radically, or we fail to meet it, in which case we change radically. Now, I think that that also sounds negative, but I think that's what kind of gives me some degree of excitement about the future, that that things are going to be radically different in 100 years, and it's not that far away. Like, you know, my kids will still be around in 2100, I hope. I might not be, but they probably will be. So it's actually really soon. All of these projections that we see in the IPCC or that we write down, and I suppose I'm excited to see how that pans out. There's obviously huge risks as well, but there's an opportunity, I think, for the human race to kind of reevaluate how it lives on this planet and find and come to a different understanding of what our role is as a species. You know, that's kind of exciting. That's kind of amazing.
Isn't it?
I think that we could do amazing things, and we've got this beautiful, beautiful planet, and the opportunity to see it become even more beautiful, or conversely, the possibility of losing a lot of what we love about it. So, you know, our decisions really matter right now. And that I think that is exciting. You have to say that's exciting as well as daunting.
Oh, I love it. And it just kind of points to this realization that I often will have, that like when we're in it, sometimes it's so hard to appreciate it, right? Like we know this. This is like basic kind of existential philosophy, basic human psychology. You don't realize what you have until it's gone. You need sort of the opposite end of the spectrum to appreciate the other end. But there's this thing, I only say this because it's the beginning of the year as we're recording this. And on my other podcast, we do these like funny psychic predictions every year. I mean, very tongue-in-cheek. But this year, we looked back. There's a guy on Twitter who, like, he's an archivist, I think, and he went through and combed through all these old newspapers to find predictions for this year from like 100 years ago.
And it's brilliant.
Fascinating to take that perspective and to go, holy wow, look where we are now, given where we thought we would be. And I don't think we take that perspective enough, because it's really illuminating, and it's I think it really can induce or at least tap into some deep, deep meaning and purpose and awe that we don't sort of give ourselves the opportunity to experience enough, especially in a busy, capitalist, kind of fear-mongering, daunting world that we live in right now. It's taking a step back for awe, that's important.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, Dr. Erica Thompson, the book Everybody is Escape from Model Land, How Mathematical Models Can Lead Us Astray and What We Can Do About It. Erica, it's been an absolute joy. I feel like I could talk to you for like 5 more hours. But the whole point, guys, is to pick up the book and you can continue to talk to her and you can learn more and more about this really important topic that I do really believe every person on this planet should have at least a tiny bit of knowledge about, because we are active, not just consumers, but participators in these models. And it's important for us to not be naive as we do consume and participate in them. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and for taking the time to be with us today for this hour.
Thank you for the invitation. And thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
I'm glad. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.